first half, second half, it's like chalk and cheese.
That can't be my best foot for money, but it's up there.
Yeah, it's no stupid red card, that's for sure.
We'll give you the balls so that we can spring on you and then claw your face off and eat your flesh.
I'm not fully keeping it together. Putting the high line with Rabbi in red. Talking the rabbits and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car, in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the High Line.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. We've got a great show for you tonight. Holding the High Line is brought to you by the Denver Post. Head on over to denverpost.com/HTHL, all lowercase, for a special deal on their digital content. We are coming to you on the evening of Tuesday, July 2nd, 2019, just hours after the emphatic victory of the United States women's national team over England in the World Cup semifinal. Rabbi Mark Goodman, for the second time in two World Cups, the U.S. women will be heading to the final. We have an opportunity pending the men against Jamaica for a spectacular 4th of July Sunday weekend result for U.S. soccer. How are you, my friend?
I am good. It was a fun game. I picked up the kids from summer camp and came home, and when my son was really little, he could not say the word girls, and he could not say the word squirrels, so he would say galurls and squalurls. So ever since then, it's been instead of the women's national team, I call them the galurls. So when the kids come home, I was saying to them, the galurls are winning. They're playing our galurls. They're our galurls. So that was our thing. And on a related note, I don't know if you listened to this other podcast that Grant Wall did about the history of the 1991 World Cup. But he pointed out some of the women in the locker room putting out this really interesting fact, which was during the final, all the fans were screaming, USA. USA. So apparently, like in China, which is where the first final was held, you don't say USA, you say USA.
Oh,
so okay. To this day, before they take the field, the U.S. women's national team chants USA. It's like their version of the LAFC cheer that they do before they go out on the field. So okay. I forget what that was called. But anyways, so yeah.
Okay, that's something. Mark, if squirrels were to ever play organized soccer, how would the playing of the ball with the tail be interpreted as far as laws of the game are concerned?
I think that I love this word because I see it in the history and the science museums. I think it's a non-prehensile tail, meaning like it's not like an iguana's tail. Like I don't think a squirrel could bat a ball around with his tail. So I don't think it would be that useful.
Okay, so then technically ball of the hand, or it's part of the rump area and therefore not even a factor because it's there. Not that we'd see squirrels. I don't get the sense that squirrels would have the dexterity in which to stand on their hind legs and then do much with their legs in order to move the ball. I feel like they're better on all fours, and in there we get back into like the total soccer show question of could a dog play on the back line as a fullback, and would the dog be able to play the ball with their front paws? Because of course in Air Bud logic, Mark, unless the laws of the game say a dog can't play soccer, you can technically have a dog on your soccer team.
See, now I'm just thinking about rodents who might be good at soccer. So like, would hedgehogs be good at soccer? Would ferrets be good at soccer?
About they'd spike the ball. Like you'd have to go through so many soccer balls with all of them and then rolling up, and then like how good are they as far as like Sonic the Hedgehog-y stuff? Like we need somebody with a little bit better balance on their actual hind legs. Maybe prairie dogs? Prairie dogs maybe?
Yeah, but they're so skittish. I mean, like they probably just would be. I mean, what prairie dog is going to go into a tough tackle against another prairie dog? Like whenever I see the prairie dogs, you know, they just run away. So
yeah, they're just going to both build a tunnel, and then the ball's just going to, you know, it's just going to go by both of them. So not
a team full of fullbacks with no defensive midfielders. That's what a prairie dog would be. So now I'm thinking about what different Gerbils and rodents would play good different positions on an all rodent soccer team. And now we're really, really way down the rabbit hole.
I feel like a fox would be really good at it, because Denmark,
foxes,
you could put the
aren't
fox.
Rodents.
They're not rodents? Ah, okay.
Oh. I don't know what they're in. They're not in the, maybe they are rodents, because they're not in the dog family and they're not in the cat family, right?
Yeah, so.
We really need to change the subject.
Okay, Mark, any thoughts that we have on the U.S. women? You know, obviously no Megan Rapinoe in the lineup, presumably a hamstring injury, but Kristen Press comes in and gets a goal. Alex Morgan takes a couple of hard tackles, but then scores on her birthday. First player in the history of the Women's World Cup to score on her birthday. Kind of a nebulous and completely irrelevant stat, if you ask me. You know, a nice little push from England in the past, but I'll be honest, Mark, as soon as I saw that PK get called and I saw the players line up and everything, and the camera went to a shot of Abby Dahlkemper, I don't know what it was in, like, my innate, like, soccer journalism, like, trying to get the, you know, trying to read the psyche of a player or the aura that they're giving out or their confidence, but, like, I saw Abby Dahlkemper, and I'm like, she's demonstrative. She's going to save this, and the U.S. is going to win 2-1.
You mean Alyssa Nair.
Alyssa Nair, excuse me. Yes,
all
Alyssa
good.
Nair.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll just say, like, I did not think that, and I was pretty nervous because Alyssa Nair, you know, I mean, one of the narratives that actually has been pretty quiet in the U.S. women's soccer world for the last year or two, it's been talked about amongst the nerds, but like,
Hope Solo's departure?
Yeah, is that nobody ever really stepped up to take, you know, Hope Solo's job by the scruff. And I remember, about a year and a half ago, I was out for the press conference that the U.S. women's national team did at Dick's Sporting Goods before they played Japan, which was easily one of the highlights of my entire soccer journalism career. Just being on the same field as the U.S. women's national team before a training and then getting to watch them train was like, it was mind blowing. The only person who wasn't there who's on the current team is Megan Rapinoe, because she was out injured for a while. But I remember going out to watch. I was going to do a story on the Rapids youth, because the Rapids, like, U16s were brought in to take shots on the goalkeepers. And the two goalkeepers at the time were Alyssa Nair and Adriana French. And then there was a third woman who isn't on the team now, and I forget who it is. But it was... It was really intimidating to watch the U.S. women's national team. You know, it's really interesting to see that, like, I've been around, you know, men's professional soccer players for 5-6 years now. And, you know, it's still kind of exciting, but not quite as much as it used to be. You know, it's like, this is, you know, the sixth time I've seen San Jose. You know, it's less of a big deal. But
seeing,
like,
Tim Howard in the hallway and saying hi is no big deal at this point. It's expected.
It's less of a big deal, but like standing 10 feet away from Kristen Press and like standing 20 feet away from Carly Lloyd was like, oh my God, I'm gonna die. It was pretty mind blowing. And I guess it's a strange thing to say. But I definitely thought to myself, one, back to the original point about the goalkeepers, that, neither of the goalkeepers was like blowing my mind with how exceptional they were, but two, man, this team is exceptionally, unbelievably good. And that's my kind of final thought about going into this World Cup with the U.S. women's team. Like, they're so over the top good at every single position. I mean, the fact that they haven't totally dominated every opponent really is more chalked up to they've been playing a little bit more carefully. Like, one of the things was, you know, with a 2-1 lead, they went to a 5-woman back line. They basically took Julie Ertz and dropped her from defensive midfielder right into the middle as like a straight up center back on a 5-woman back line. And I thought that was a really interesting decision, and it was a very like it was either a overly conservative, foolhardy decision, you could read it that way. The other way you could read it is, we are so confident in our defense that we're just going to drop one more person back in there, and there's no way they're going to score on us. And it basically worked. I mean, that's basically, England looked totally ineffective, with the exception of that one penalty that the U.S. drew.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you, Mark. You know, you said I'll definitely take the latter in terms of the tactical approach with Jill Ellis, you know, modifying the 4-3-3 into a 4-5-1, or I think it was a 4-3, it was a 5-3-2 at times as well, depending on who was on the field and one of the wingers dropping back as well. But I mean, Julie Ertz has been the N'Golo Kanté of this tournament, as far as France and the men's World Cup in Russia last year to the U.S. women this year, in terms of just cleaning everything up, transitioning stuff into the attack as well. I think Lindsey Horan had a little bit of a rough game. It was really, really physical and really chippy, and I'm not sure if that was founded off of the U.S. trying to make the game ugly or just England's frustration for the game, but that was really unfortunate for me to see, maybe some unsporting behavior by both sides, but you know, especially in the second half. But that calmed down, and eventually England had urgency. And I think what's really benefited the U.S. relative to the 2015 World Cup, where they had a little bit of a slow start and they had to take their lumps going through games, they've just been such fast starters. You know, they got the first goal against Spain, obviously Megan Rapinoe, you know, with her almost like her, you know, are you not entertained, the two hands up in the air that have gone viral on the set piece as well. The U.S. is scored first, and that's made things so much easier than it was at times in the She Believe Cup this year, in which England got a 2-2 draw against the U.S. and won that tournament. And definitely in the 2015 World Cup, where the U.S. had slow starts, or they went down, or they had to defend things. It is so much easier in these international games when you have a tactical approach, switching from the 4-3-3, moving Julie Ertz to center back, that will single-handedly shut down the opponent if you are able to get the first goal and get that first goal early on in the game. That gives you so much more confidence. It immediately gives the opponent urgency, and it immediately gives them almost panic, really. We saw it for France, and we definitely saw it at times for England as well, knowing we're playing a better team, we're playing a very good defensive team, we're playing a team that, even though they have weaknesses, Jill Ellis has weapons in the bag, both in Julie Ertz and in bench options, that are going to take that away. That it's almost, you're surprised they've been blowing people out, Mark. I've been almost surprised at how the U.S. has been able to, given how bad their defense was and knowing that was such a weakness, how much they've been able to single-handedly strangle the game off. They got a 2-0 lead against France, and they said, we're shutting this game down. The only chance you have to win, to get back into this game, is on a set piece with Rainier, because she is 3 inches taller than every single other player in the field, and you just put the ball where none of our other defenders can get to it. And that's the one good chance that France has. You know, like, let's say if it ends up being Sweden in the final of the U.S. play. If the U.S. score first, regardless of when it is, the game's over. Sweden's not getting two goals. You know, I know the Netherlands has a little bit more of attack in this one, but Jill Ellis' side has to be extremely proud. They've got to be flying high at this point. They have to be very confident and very focused going into the game on Sunday. I think the only real question is some of the tactical nuances or second half changes that Jill Ellis is going to have in the bag, depending on who the opponent is, and the question of the health of Megan Rapinoe. And if Megan Rapinoe is healthy, guys, you know, it's lights out. Mark, did you read Sue Bird's article in the Players Tribune today?
No.
Okay, Sue Bird is a WNBA player. She is a point guard for the Seattle team, the name of which escapes me, that is, I believe, not named the Supersonics. And she is girlfriend, they're contemplating other stuff, with Megan Rapinoe. And so the article title was, "The President Hates My Blank Girlfriend." And in the end, she was in the locker room at halftime, and she was talking about the dynamic and everything. And this was the final of the 2015 World Cup. And so she doesn't remember who, but everybody's going through the tactical approach. Everybody's super serious, like, we're going to come out and we're going to stomp on Japan's throat and everything. Like, we are not losing this game. We're focused. And at some point, you could see one player, she doesn't remember who. I feel like this is totally something Megan Rapinoe would have done, though. Just sort of giddy in the corner, getting super excited. And she just stands up and she says, like, come on, we're gonna win the World Cup, and like, everybody just completely loses it at that point. And I feel like that is the level of focus that the women come out to, where like, just, I, there is no doubt in my mind, pending team-wide pending like team-wide food poisoning or just a total Geiger show against them in the final on Sunday, that the U.S. women isn't walking out with another World Cup on Sunday.
4 stars, baby. Let's put it over the crest. Although, you know, I don't like to make predictions, because I've been having a really bad run with predictions. So I'm really hoping that I'm not predicting anything, but I do think the U.S. it's their game to lose, absolutely. But that's been every game of the tournament. They've always been the strongest team. I personally felt like once they got past France, it felt like everything opened up. Like, I wasn't nearly as worried about England as I was about France.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Mark, speaking of other emphatic victories that the fan base of the winning team has to be super excited and confident about, this past Friday at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, the Colorado Rapids were victorious against the league leaders and smug-faced Bob Bradley's LAFC by a score of 1-0, a goal off of a set piece in the 49th minute by one Danny Wilson. On the assist was Jack Price, who's been taking the corner for the Pids. A little bit of a nervous first 10 minutes as far as the LAFC taking a lot of chances and trying to get the ball to Carlos Vela. Mark, you saw that they were targeting Sam Vines early and often and were kind of switching the field as far as Vela going to one side and Rossi going to fill in the other space to try and go at right back Keegan Rosenberry as well. You had a couple decent counterattack from the Pids, mostly in a turnover created by the midfield combination of Jack Price and Danny Wilson. That leads to Kellen Acosta getting the ball and Andre Shinyashiki almost shifting up to make like a 4-2-2-2 cockeyed a little bit with Kai Kamara. Not a lot of chemistry there, but a couple of chances created by both sides. Then obviously you have the Danny Wilson goal at the 49th minute. And then on the radio call with Connor Cape right behind me, Mark, was Bobby Burling. And then in the 52nd minute, there is lightning spotted in the area, and we get a delay of just under 60 minutes. And I was talking with Bobby Burling about that at that time, and he said it's just such an absolute punch in the gut in terms of, like, your adrenaline, scoring a goal, wanting to go for a second, and immediately it powers down to zero. And whenever the game gets back started again, you have to ramp up so quickly, and that's just so hard to do, especially off of the adrenaline of getting such a huge goal in such a huge game for the Rapids. We resume in the 53rd minute, about 60 minutes after the initial delay, after about a 10-minute warm-up, and LAFC makes a couple substitutions. They bring Perez into the game, and they create a couple chances. They miss a couple sitters. If you ask me, Dylan Serna comes into the game as well, but overall, a very unexciting half chances in the final 20 minutes, and the Rapids ultimately get a result, and they get 3 points that, let's be real, Mark, not a lot of teams in the Western Conference are going to play LAFC on the road and get 3 points in the way the Rapids did it. Rabbi Mark Goodman, what was your good thing from, I would say, the signature win of the season?
I would say, I mean, the other thing to your point was, to this point, LAFC has only lost, before this point, LAFC had only lost one game. So when you said not a lot of teams, the literal immediate response is, yeah, exactly one team has been able to beat this LAFC team. A person who wanted to explain the defeat could say, well, they didn't have Walker Zimmerman, they were missing a couple of other key players, but on the flip side, the Rapids were missing Jonathan Lewis, who is something of a key player for them. It is definitely a signature win. I mean, I think the signature wins will start coming as the season gets longer if the team is still in any way, shape, or form in the playoff hunt, which is possible. It just requires a Herculean effort of amazing soccer for the next like 7 games. They just need to chunk it in like 7 game chunks and they should be okay. The good thing about this game, I think, you know, you already mentioned, which was Sam Vines putting everybody in his pocket. He just totally dominated that side. He just held down what would be for LAFC the right side of their attack. When Carlos Vela came on at Sam Vines, Vines kept him in front of him no matter what. He just never moved. And in fact, the entire defensive back line did a great job of just keeping their man in front of them no matter what, and waiting for a defensive midfielder to arrive and kind of seal off, you know, the other direction. So if Vines was going outside, then Kellen Acosta would come over and take away inside. And that just kept working over and over and over throughout the game. You know, if you go back and you look at almost every LAFC possession, it just kept looking like there were no outlets. There was no daylight. They weren't in a good position to face up and take a shot, with the exception of like the first 15 minutes when LAFC got a couple of open shots that they really should have taken. The only thing I'll add is really something that goes better for a bad thing, which is I'm waiting for the expected goals numbers to come out. They come out about a week after the game. Only MLS or anybody who pays Opta for the privilege of seeing the data can see it. But my guess would be that in terms of expected goals, LAFC had a better number than the Rapids. The Rapids didn't have as really good looks as LAFC did. LAFC was a little profligate in front of goal, and the Rapids got a little bit lucky. But that's more for big thing than it is, or for bad thing than it is for good thing. Good thing is this team can defend when they want to, which is something we did not see at the beginning of the season.
No, absolutely, Mark. I'm going to go with the fullbacks as far as my good thing. I had this thought initially, and then I asked initially Tim Howard about it after the game, and he basically said exactly what I was thinking without me giving him a leading question or basically explaining my thinking, and then, do you agree? And Tim said, yeah, sure. So if you look on paper, Mark, this was a matchup where the Rapids were going to be massively outgunned on the flanks. Previously, during this winning streak, we saw where the biggest man for the Rapids was on the flanks on both sides of the ball, and that mostly came with Jonathan Lewis, as you mentioned, playing on the left side of the field, and then some combination of either Diego Rubio or Sam Nicholson on the right side, and Shin Yoshigi's had some good moments mostly on the left as well. But I mean, like, you're talking about two DPs, probably the best 1-2 punch in Carlos Vela, who's probably winning the MVP, and Diego Rossi, who is absolutely the Robin to Carlos Vela's Batman. And you had that against a teenage homegrown player, and let's face it, you know, a decent American right back as of 2018 got called up for the January camp and has had a really underwhelming club season and really isn't in the conversation for the right back position for the U.S. national team, where Greg Berhalter is looking for any other option than DeAndre Yedlin right now, given his injury and possibly wanting to play him in the midfield as well. So much so that Tyler Adams would be being played at that role, and that's not even his natural position. So what does that say about Keegan Rosenberry's fall from grace between January to the initial Gold Cup roster, of which he didn't even make the preliminary roster? And so you had those two guys matched up against the best 1-2 punch in a 4-3-3 on the wide attacking side on the field. Those two individually were going to have their best game of the season, and collectively we're going to have their best game of the season. And both of those things occurred, Mark. Keegan Rosenberry shut Diego Rubio down. Sam Vines, we had a really good, maybe 2-minute sequence of him marking Carlos Pavon in the Boca Juniors friendly last year, and those 2 minutes were absolutely fantastic, and I thought, you know, were a good indication of his potential as well, but it was a small sample size. We got 90 minutes on Friday of that level of Sam Vines against the best winger threat in Major League Soccer right now, and it was absolutely fantastic. I thought it was a great defensive performance at all. I don't know how good of an angle you had from the MLS live view that Altitude was showing, Mark, but it almost got into the final third like the Rapids completely forgot about formation and just went to straight man marking. Adama Diamande was in the middle. One of the center backs was going to get him. One of them was going to maybe cheat somewhere else. Jack Price and Danny Wilson's movement was excellent, and the wingers for the Rapids, Rubio and Shin Yoshigi, were regularly cheating back to help out Sam Vines. This was a defensive masterclass on alertness, on, I would almost say, like, heavy metal football level intensity, but doing that in parking the bus, if that makes sense. And it worked to a T for a whole of 90 minutes, and it frustrated LAFC, and by the transitive property, the Rapids tied the Vancouver Whitecaps, who then beat LAFC, and then the Rapids themselves beat LAFC, and the Rapids now have 2 wins over Los Angeles. So by the transitive property, when the LA Galaxy supporters and LAFC supporters make a trophy for El Tráfico, they should be sending it to Commerce City, no?
Yeah, I've never been a big fan of the transitive property as applies to soccer teams, because otherwise, like, at some point, based on the fact that I once played one-on-one against Kurt Rambis, I am the NBA's 1994 MVP of the league, or something like that.
Okay, Mark, well, where do you want to start with bad thing for this match?
Are there bad things? was there a bad thing? I mean, I'll have a bad thing, but it's not really a bad thing, which is, and this was pointed out by, Bobby Warshaw, from MLS. He pointed out that 6 of the Rapids' last 12 goals have come via set pieces and, corner kicks. He said specifically corner kicks. And this one came via corner kicks and a corner kick. And, that's not a bad thing. It's just, it's interesting that the Rapids are playing bunker and counter, and win on set pieces. And that's just a thing that, you know, they're going to come to be known for, that teams are going to start preparing in advance, to stop them on their corner piece, set piece, routines. But I think I've said that already for 2 weeks, like, oh, people are going to start to expect what the Rapids are going to do. And nobody has. Nobody has figured them out yet. They still can do it. So I don't have a bad thing, Matt. I just have some, you know, I have my kind of weekly concerns that are basically like, can this streak hold? And the answer so far is yes, you idiot. It's doing fine. Stop worrying. Do you have a bad thing?
I have a couple things that I'm concerned about or that I'm looking for in the future that might be problems, might be me just looking for something for the sake of hashtag narrative. And so, to your point, Mark, about the team being kind of smash and grab on the counter off of Bobby Warshaw's piece this week, I'm still a little bit concerned about the possession numbers. You know, the Rapids during this winning streak have been very, you know, a good game for them is about 40% possession per the stats at MLS Soccer. They had 34.4% possession against LAFC. And during this win streak, that's been about typical. It's somewhere between 30 and 40%. So they're conservative letting the opponent have the ball. And they're letting the opponent have the ball even when they've played weaker teams, especially when they've played them at home as well. And in some of those games, that's also been with the scoreline still being relatively close. You know, it was 2 goals in the final 20 minutes of the game against both, I think it was Minnesota, FC Cincinnati and Columbus that all required second half goals for the Rapids. So at some point there was an extended period with the game being within 1 goal and certainly with it being a tied game in which the opponent is dominating possession against the Rapids as a weaker team playing on the road. I think some of that certainly plays to the advantages of what Connor Casey's trying to do. He's definitely having a very finite game approach to it, where as opposed to trying to build to something bigger and, you know, Anthony Hudson was thinking, I've got 5 years to finally get this right. Like, let's build it slowly and everything. Connor Casey's, like, his mind isn't thinking about more than a week at the time. So, you know, he was focused on LAFC as of the Friday before then. He's focused on New England Revolution. He's not going to be thinking about the Portland Timbers until, you know, 12:01, just past midnight on Friday of this week as well. And so in that, he's playing a style play that's reflective of what's getting results and what's working for his team, but might not be sustainable over the course of an extended season or a longer period. Furthermore, it's effectively just hashtag keep fighting the Pablo Mascherini approach, but he's doing it as a former forward, where effectively he was the offensive coordinator under both Hudson and under Mascherini. Anytime I spoke with one of the forwards about what they're doing in training or what they're trying to prove, and it's like, oh yeah, I'm working with Connor and we're working on A, B, and C, and this is working and he's helping me out with that. Heard that from Don Baji, heard that from Joe Mason, hearing that from Kai Kamara, and certainly in Andre Shinyashiki right now as well, and even Nicky Jackson last year as well. So where Pablo Mascherini didn't, from a player standpoint, didn't really think about anything beyond let's win the ball and get it out to somebody wide, Connor Casey's thinking about it from a forward perspective of how do I have to connect the dots such that the final dot is Kai Kamara's forehead, which is not that dissimilar from how Connor Casey approached things as a player, where it's what do I need to do to get open for Cummings to find me, and then for him to find my forehead and for me to score a goal. In that, he is a better iteration of what hashtag keep fighting and what Pablo Ball was, in that he is also a complete reverse back to the pre-Denver Post Rapids Way op-ed. And so in the context of the greater team, is that a factor that Porig Smith and the other leadership is considering as they look forward to a new head coaching search? Is the style of play and the results impacting whether or not Connor is a candidate for that position, and is this affecting at all what Porg's ethos was for how to get the Rapids to be successful in MLS 3.0, or are we just going to revert back to something to where, you know, there's a, like, if Pablo Mascherini was watching the game on Friday, there's a small piece of him that was crying a tear of joy. There was another piece of him that was thinking, I got fired by Porg for not doing what he wanted to, and the team is winning doing exactly what I would have done, and I did it with a bottom barrel team in terms of salary. Could I be doing this exact same thing right now with the current skill of players if I had somebody the level of Kai Kamara or a Jonathan Lewis or a young, I'd say in a positive way, cocky talent in Andre Shinyashiki? Those are questions I'm wondering about and things that I'd be wondering if I were Pork as far as making, as far as the future direction of the club in the context of the coaching hire that I'm doing and where I'm going with the next two DPs that we'll be bringing in January. And then the other question that I kind of have, we've seen at times, especially the last couple of games, where Andre's been a little bit frustrated either with himself or with the service that he's getting from a wide position, or where he's been having conversations after the play where something didn't go right between him and Kai Kamara. And is that rookie mistakes that he's maybe working through? Is he frustrated with some of his teammates? Are he and Kai Kamara not communicating? I want to emphasize this is a really, really minor thing, and it hasn't affected results. And maybe this is completely normal, and Andre just has some growing pains, and maybe this is going to be a good thing in the long run. But that's something that I've seen from him in a wide role that I didn't really notice when he was an underneath striker. And in that, I'm kind of wondering if that's really a good fit for him, in the same way that I've had concerns about Diego Rubio in that position. You know, if everybody's healthy, for me, honestly, Mark, I'm probably thinking Rubio's best position on the field, or the way for him to get the most playing time, is probably underneath Kai Kamara. He might not even be a starter in that role. And my two starters on the wing are probably Nicholson and Lewis, with Shinyashiki being the first sub for that option. Any thoughts on that, Mark? And shall we get to Big Thing?
I was just gonna, I'll transition to Big Thing, which is my simple response is that you made a really great comment about whether Connor Casey's success is starting to change the conversation around the Rapids hiring a coach, and what a really complicated issue that is. I mean, think about the fact that Connor Casey is doing so well that he's potentially making hiring another coach a difficult situation, because replacing him is actually going to be hard because he's doing so well. I wonder, you know, I have heard rumblings that the team had already pretty much hired a coach, and that they knew who they were going to get, and that they were just kind of waiting for the right time. And I wonder whether either that was not true, or whether that was true back then, but it's changing now, or whether that's still the plan right now. That Colorado was definitely going to be hiring one of the three big American names that everybody have been talking about, Robin Fraser, Tab Ramos, and Josh Wolf, and that they're just waiting for the right moment to spring it. Whether any of those guys is the right guy, whether their way of playing is going to be the same or different as what Connor Casey has established, or whether the smart thing isn't to just let Connor Casey have a full year under his belt, and then potentially, no matter how well he does, transition him out potentially to being the new coach in Colorado Springs. So that was a good comment you made, Matt. I don't have any good answers here. I did just drop a little bit of knowledge on Rapids fans. A little bit of inside information, at least rumblings that I heard from folks inside and outside the club about who the finalists are. But we'll see. You know, I know that rumors are rumors and stories are stories. So I don't really have, I'm not privy to any of the good info. I wish I was, man, because then I get all the money for all the years.
Yeah.
No,
the only thing that I can add from a reporting standpoint, because, you know, I've been shaking down some trees and getting some tidbits as well, and I would say the usual banter that's been what's out there, I haven't heard anything different that contradicts that. So I think nothing concrete, but, you know, it's not going to be a totally out of the standpoint thing. You know, Mark, if I had told you the day after Pablo Mascherini got fired that the Rapids were going after a guy who's most recent recent who was coaching in Oceania, for example, I would have said, you're completely crazy, or I want some more backstory, or like, I want to hear some things. You know, it's going to be one of the usual suspects that's been talked about, and it's going to be one of the guys who really, you know, if I go back and look at every single, you know, next upcoming American head coach in MLS shortlist, you know, Tab Ramos was probably at the top of that, initially. Robin Fraser is usually one of those candidates that's pittered about every single year, as he has for really the best past five years as one of the best assistant coaches in MLS. And maybe not at the beginning of this year, just given the transition coming over, but I think there's a lot of respect in the sense that Greg Berhalter is building a really, really good coaching tree. And I think the first candidate that could be reflective of that is probably going to be Josh Wolf. And whether that's continuing with him as an assistant coach or getting another opportunity in the future, like you could tell when Josh Wolf, was a player with Berhalter, and that I believe he also played, I believe Berhalter also coached him, that you saw Josh Wolf was a coach on the field for an extended period of time, and that Berhalter's been grooming him in that aspect in the way that we've seen other coaches in other sports as well. So I think at some point in his career, Josh Wolf will be given the opportunity and will do well as a head coach somewhere in soccer, either at the club or the country level. And so in that, if you're saying, oh, find me an American who's not a current head coach of an MLS team who's going to take over that, those are three of the first fives that you're going to get. You know, Pep Guardiola isn't calling Commerce City, Colorado. Arsene Wenger isn't frequenting the field at all. And he's not thinking about that, except maybe thinking, oh, who's that one player from Arsenal who I'm interested in? Let's see what they're doing on their American tour to see if they're getting an opportunity from Unai Emery. That's the extent to which the Colorado Rapids are on Arsene Wenger's radar, and certainly nothing of the caliber of Jose Mourinho, who would be an absolute disaster from a media standpoint. And I hope for my selfish stake, isn't what happens. Let's transition, speaking of that, Mark, to some news that we got on the farm standpoint. Yesterday, the Colorado Springs Switchbacks parted with their first and only, head coach in Steve Trischute. He was, relieved of his duties, and Wold Harris, who was the main interim under Trischute, has taken over as interim head coach. And presumably the Switchbacks will be looking forward to a new hire. The Switchbacks have had a pretty terrible season, Mark. They've been a very, very bad team. They're an underman team in terms of the level of squad they have, and I think this speaks to some of the just general rumblings of, are they a team that's going to fit in the 2019 era, and the level of which the USL is aspiring to make the USL championship, or would they be better off in one of the lower divisions? And how much of this is Trischute's fault, as opposed to just frankly the club falling behind from their initial season when they were top of the Western Conference and were the number one seed going into the playoffs? Your thoughts on this, and maybe in particular, given some of the comments that we've seen on Twitter, how this impacts some of the players with the Switchbacks, including but not limited to one Sam Rabin.
Yeah, I mean, you set me up real nice there. The first comment on the website, on Twitter, about Trisha being fired was somebody saying, well, that's good. Hopefully they'll move forward with someone who will use the players better, something to that effect. The comment was from David Rabin, that's Sam Rabin's dad, which is pretty fierce. One way of kind of looking at maybe one of the reasons why Trisha might have been fired is that Rabin wasn't getting as many chances to start. Neither was Matt Hundley. Hundley was playing, starting about half the games, but not all the games. So one of the questions being, are the Rapids really getting the players that they sent down there to have the time that they need in order to develop? Another question was whether the Switchbacks really had the lineup to begin with to compete. They've had, you know, better lineups in the past, better lists of players in the past. And I think this year they were missing a number of, really critical and, you know, talented players, who could have been helpful to them. So, the one who kind of jumped out at me was, I remember, Josh Suggs, who was a fullback for them a couple years ago. Really talented player, really helped drive the offense, and they didn't retain him for this year. And hasn't, I think he's also hurt. So even if they had, it might not have mattered, but, you know, they were really, they really didn't bring any players back from the USL team from last year who were impact players. They're kind of scuffling with who they have and then adding the players that the Rapids sent down to them. So I don't think they really ever figured out what the core of that club was. And USL is moving along with some really difficult, really, really high talented, high end players. They're getting better every year. The quality of players getting better every year. You know, and that's also due to the selectiveness of MLS that, MLS is sending, you know, more of the college super draft players back into the USL, and picking up fewer of them. So more of the top NCAA players are winding up in USL. And to conclude the thought, the switchbacks did not get this year a lot of those guys.
Yeah, no, really good points, Mark. You know, I've penned a couple things, and so has our colleague Mark Turner on there, about the direction the switchbacks are going, and really just a question of how the relationship is working, and they hadn't really figured that out. And I think some of that might have been a disconnect due to just what the staff was. And, you know, okay, well, I'll give some, you know, benefit of the doubt here, that, you know, Brian Crookham, 6 months on the job, probably hadn't been watching USL as seriously as he is now, you know, 6 months ago. Maybe some of that was a little bit of a learning curve. I don't think that the situation with where the club is right now should be faulted on the Rapids in that aspect. You know, obviously they had immediate urgent needs in trying to get results at the first team level, and maybe that meant that some of the younger talent, like a Sam Vines, who was really, really good in Charlotte last year, would have been in position to be successful, you know, with the switchbacks in USL this year. At the same time, he's made strides to where he's an effective player in MLS. And, you know, Connor Casey doesn't really have any other options right now, given the, you know, the injury and some of the issues going on with one Declan Wynn. So, you know, but whether it was the team's poor play, the injuries, the midseason coaching switch from the Rapids standpoint, their hands were tied in terms of they needed to worry about themselves. So, you know, Kai Kamara and Jack Price and Tim Howard weren't being sent down to the switchbacks anytime soon in that respect. And so I guess I just wonder, you know, how much of, you know, do the Rapids need to figure things out and find a more symbiotic relationship that's not just sending a bunch of, you know, the U20s, academy kids down on a Friday night, you know, Friday morning, getting one training session in, setting them up in a hotel with a chaperone, and then playing the game on Saturday and then driving back up to Denver the game after. I think they need a more coherent plan in terms of how they're going to connect what's going on with the first team for the Rapids and what's going on with the switchback in a way that benefits both the development of those Rapids players and actually getting a result. In that respect, Trishu, that was one thing where he was delinquent, but I think some of the other issues they had were more widespread. If you exclude the Rapids loan players, Mark, the switchbacks had 14 players on their first team roster at the beginning of the season. They literally had the minimum amount to where if you've got one guy injured, like, you literally don't even have the right number of subs in this one. And that included them having two goalkeepers as well. So, I mean, you know, they didn't need Andre Rolls is helping the team. He's been a starter for them and he's been decent in the time that I've seen him there, but like, they don't need another goalkeeper in that respect. They have other positions that are greater positions of need. And, you know, Trish, to his defense, he's had one attacking sub with any regularity on the bench, and it's a 19-year-old Matt Hundley. Could he have been working with Matt Hundley better in terms of in training, preparing him from that standpoint? Yeah, but if you fundamentally only have one body available, if Matt Hundley's starting, then that one attacking piece comes out, you still only have one other option. You know, imagine the Rapids attack right now if suddenly, you know, Jonathan Lewis and Andre Shinyashiki didn't exist. So then, okay, Nicholson and Rubio by de facto have to be starters, and that pretty much requires you to bring Nicky Jackson back up from Charlotte, and Nicky Jackson is your one substitute option at that point. And if Nicky Jackson's starting, you still only have one substitute option, and that limits you in terms of the shape that you can play, how you can change things, and where those players are actually comfortable. And in that, I think it's fair for Trishu to probably look in ownership and think, I've got 14 players. They're not very good, as you said, Mark, in terms of the level of talent. Like, it's hard to compete with you know, with Phoenix Rising, who's pumping a bunch of money into the first team and trying to push for, you know, MLS. The same thing for, you know, for a Sacramento Republic or some of the other really good teams in the Western Conference. And, you know, at the very least, with the ones who have a full-on MLS contingency, you know, those are clubs in the Western Conference who are full in on hashtag play your kids. So they're getting quality talent where, you know, the equivalent of Cole Bassett on the Seattle Sounders organization is playing with Tacoma right now. And so in that, I think there's going to have to be some changes. I think some of that comes with Brian Crookham getting more familiar with the role and him getting the switchbacks and the Rapids on the same page and in a way that works for both of them. And I think some of that is fundamentally going to have to come from leadership with the switchbacks as far as financial contribution, getting the stadium up and running for this to be a competent club in the USL Championship. You could speak to this better than me, Mark, but the USL has kind of been really laissez-faire with if teams want to self-relegate to League One, that's okay. But as we've said, USL Championship is approaching, you know, 40 clubs. I think at some point the USL is going to have to go to some of those weaker clubs and say, you're USL League One now. And I'm wondering if the switchbacks are starting to get on that shortlist.
I don't think so. I think USL and MLS think about financial ability more so than they think about competitiveness right now. And I think, you know, promotion relegation is another topic that they're not quite ready to deal with. There's definitely an aspect to which those two overlap, that if you can't financially spend the money on your club, you're going to wind up losing a lot of games, and then you're going to want to wind up dropping down, and it has to do with money. But I was looking just now at the switchbacks numbers, and the important numbers for the switchbacks is that they've been growing average attendance year over year, every single year from in the mid 2000s in their first season too, but about 3,800 a game now for a stadium that holds 5,000. And those are good, solid, USL championship numbers. So I feel like, the switchbacks have established themselves. I think the other reason that's the case is that the baseball team moved out of town. The AAA team that the Rockies had down there. And so I think that gives the switchbacks some competitive advantages. I also think that, but you do make a good point that if the ownership doesn't want to spend big to get a couple more talented USL midfielders, I mean they kind of used a couple of picked over guys, Jamal Jack, who's a fine defender, but he's you know kind of very like he's on the decline. Ish Jome, who they brought in to be the kind of central midfield pivot, but like these weren't you know, top echelon USL guys or guys who came out of, top NCAA programs this year and were, you know, just on the cusp of MLS. Like, there weren't a lot of guys like that. So that's a thing they're going to have to invest in if they want to move forward as a club and be more than just a bottom feeder in USL Championship. Another way of framing it, just to conclude the thought, is that, one question that you could ask about USL Championship and USL 1 is whether they're just too big right now. I mean, the two divisions together have something like 55 clubs or something like that in them. And USL Championship has an Eastern Conference and a Western Conference that have, I think, 13 and 16 teams respectively. And that's just insane. It's just, or maybe it's, I think it's 17 teams in the USL East. It's just too big. And that's a different question for a different podcast.
No, absolutely, Mark. We will touch on this a little bit in Ask HDHL. Shall we move on to previewing this week's game?
Let's.
All right, listeners, we are currently 18-34 through the 2019 Colorado Rapids season. That reduces down to 9/17, if my math is correct. The Colorado Rapids have 19 points off of the 18 games played. That is good for 11th in the Western Conference, just ahead of Sporting Kansas City, who also have 19 points but have fewer wins. Wins is one of the tiebreakers, SKC with a bunch of draws. But in any case, the Rapids have 9 wins, have 5 wins, 9 losses, and 4 draws. They have a -8 goal differential, and despite their placement, Mark, they are just 5 points below the red line. They do have, however, have to jump 4 teams in order to get there. there. They are playing on Thursday, July the 4th at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Fittingly, thematically, given 4th of July, they'll be playing the New England Revolution, whose crest is literally the United States flag with a soccer ball with blue and white star panels, as the blue background with the white, stars. The New England Revolution, have played 18 games the season mark. They have 20 points, 5-8-5 is their record with a negative 15 goal differential. That is good for ninth in the Eastern Conference. They are just 3 points below the red line with Orlando City just ahead of them. The Revolution have had a very tumultuous season mark. They're basically the Rapids of the East at this point. They made a bunch of changes in the offseason. They kind of had an old guard that was a carryover going back to the Jay Heaps days. There was an expectation that there was going to be gradual improvement, albeit not in the direction to actually winning and making the playoffs under second year manager Brad Friedel. Like Anthony Hudson, Brad Friedel had some incendiary comments, but his were a little bit extreme, where he basically said that, like, there's not enough pressure because MLS doesn't have relegation. There's not enough pressure from the Revs fan base and the supporters. When I played a bad game in England, like, you would get confronted by fans and they would be, like, threatening violence to me when I was at Blackburn. And I think we need more of that pressure, in MLS. I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, folks, but basically the quote mark, a lot of people read that and said, are you advocating for fan violence against the players? They then proceeded to have a really terrible game. I think they lost something like 5-0 on the midweek. You could see that the players had completely given up, and clearly Friedel had lost the locker room. He was fired. Two teams similar to the Rapids, New England was kind of in a similar position about doubting how much money were they actually going to spend. There were a lot of parallels to Stan Kroenke and who are the owners of the Revolution and the Patriots, whose name is escaping me, Robert Kraft, in terms of similar extreme fascination and obsession with their NFL teams, whom played each other in this past Super Bowl that the Patriots won, and an extreme level of disinterest in terms of pawning off one of their lesser children to run the nitty-gritty little MLS team on a minimum budget. And then the Krafts came in and said that we were willing to spend a little bit more money. They completely cleaned house with the front office and brought in who will eventually overtake the late Siggy Smith this season, MLS head coach Bruce Arena of the DC United dynasty, of the LA Galaxy dynasty. And he said that I wouldn't have taken this position if I didn't think it was a chance for me to turn around the club, and we were going to spend a whole bunch more money. And in typical Bruce Arena fashion, he said, we're going to get way more value out of the MLS budget players, and we're going to pick and choose really good international players to bring in who are going to make an impact. The Revolution roster remains relatively unchanged as of now, but that could be changing. Not relevant for this game, but I'm really curious to see what Bruce Arena does with this roster overall, Mark. Their defense is backed by Andrew Farrell, out of Louisville, Kentucky, who was a number one pick back in the MLS Super Draft a number of years ago. Matt Turner is their main goalkeeper, and Bruce Arena's been playing around with the formation. At times, they've looked like a flat 4-4-2. At times, they've looked like the 4-4-2-Y formation with a holding midfielder and then a true number 8, kind of a truncated version between a flat 4-man midfield and a 4-1-3-2 that can look like a diamond as well. You've spoken very highly, Mark, about the Janinho, Marcelo Sarvas, Baggio Husidic dynamic that the LA Galaxy had under a one Bruce Arena, and it's looked like he's starting to replicate that as well with Diego Fagundes and Juan Agudelo, who for the moment has had a renaissance under Bruce Arena. But I've seen this so many times with him with the Revs, Mark, that I'm not getting my hopes up in terms of Agudelo being able to contribute to the U.S. national team. Their big central attacking midfielder is the Spaniard Carlos Gil, who's a pretty good shout for MLS Fantasy this week and when the Revs have a DGW on the round, Mark. He's a Spaniard. Most recently was playing in Liga MX, I believe, with Necaxa. Don't quote me. And then their main attacking threat up front is one Teal Bunbury, who wears the number 10, was with Sporting Kansas City for a long time, and then is banging in goals with the New England Revolution. And then, of course, Mark, on the back line next to Andrew Farrell is former Rapid Edgar Castillo, who's been playing at the left-back position for the Revs. Mark, what do you see in the Revolution? Do you agree with some of my comparisons and similarities between the two teams? And, like, the Rapids are just going to roll stomp this team 1-0 on a set piece on Thursday, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just read another piece that talked about how Bruce Arena has gone to this diamond formation that you were mentioning before. You know, New England has gotten a lot of mileage out of a brand new player, Carlos Gil, who's this little dribbly Spaniard who they brought in. And I think he's their designated player this year. And then you've got, Fagundes and Agudelo, who, as you mentioned, are both great players. But probably a little bit disappointing. They're a pretty, they have, gone undefeated in 7 games, which is huge, but whether they are, whether this is like immovable object meets unstoppable force is a really good question. You know, both of these teams, Colorado and New England, are just on the upswing and doing really well. One of them is going to have to kind of show the cracks in the armor. We are seeing it through our lens, which is that we've been watching the Rapids. They look, you know, phenomenal. They, you know, predicting that our own team is going to suddenly drop the ball and be poor after the week after beating the best team in MLS seems unfathomable. But that being said, like, New England is doing a lot better and has created a lot of things, that they weren't creating before and have been tidy with the ball, and they just haven't been making mistakes. And when you do that, you give yourself a chance in every game.
As fireworks go off in the background, no, I agree with you, Mark. You know, I think we see a lot of similarities in this team in terms of the new coach coming in and definitely seeing, you know, changing things tactically. And obviously Connor Casey went, you know, on a drastic, completely different front than what Anthony Hudson was trying to do. And Bruce Arena's effectively replicating a system and a formation with similar pieces that he had success with DC United in a 4-4-2 and with Marco Echeverri, and what he's able to find some level of success with the New England Revolution. We've seen a little bit more experimentation in terms of Bruce Arena rotating out the squad since he's taken over, and then also switching up both the formation and where players are playing in that formation. You know, Fagundes has mostly been in one of those wide shuttler roles, as has Juan Agudelo. I'd say Fagundes is maybe in the Mike McGee role, if I'm, you know, calling back way to old school MLS 2.0 and what Bruce Arena was doing with the Galaxy. I feel like in where Connor Casey is as an interim head coach, he has a better sense of where his squad is, and he knows what he's getting out of each player, and he has more of a hierarchy. I think that Bruce Arena is still a little bit in the feeling out phase in terms of a, let me experiment with this guy in this role, in this formation, and see what actually I have. Obviously, Casey's coming at it from approach of, I'm an interim, my job is to get results. Bruce Arena's probably thinking, worst case scenario, this season's a complete loss. Let me get stock of where I am, maybe pull a couple of small moves in the secondary transfer window that I think are going to be good in the long run, but then definitely do a full overhaul as I see necessary over the course of the winter as well. So in that, I think there's maybe a lot more unknown. At the same time, I think Bruce Arena is going to be higher risk, high reward in this game, whereas we know what to expect from Connor Casey, and in that, there's a little bit of consistency. How predictable are, you know, is what they're, how predictable is it going to be in what they see from the Revolution, and how well is Connor Casey going to be able to adjust to seeing something unexpected, or certainly against one of the guys who, you know, is one of the better, you know, adjustment coaches in terms of changing things at halftime or bringing on a sub in what Bruce Arena is able to do. The Revs, as you said, Mark, you know, are on a 7-game unbeaten streak, but their record in road games this year is just 1-4-3. And so I wonder, especially with all the home games Bruce Arena's been managing, how much of that is him just being able to control things at home, and certainly playing on turf, which is an advantage the Revolution have that might be as big or bigger in some cases compared to the Rapids getting to play at altitude. That one road win for the New England Revolution, Mark. However, I believe the first time that Bruce Arena was on the sideline for the Revolution, and it was at Los Angeles, and they defeated the LA Galaxy by a score of 2-1. So we could be in for some fireworks, literal, both on the field and after the 90 minutes in this game, and I'm really excited to see what they do. I do think the Rapids can get a result in this one, just given where they are and just what we, especially coming off of the result that they had on Friday. I don't think this is going to be a trap game. I think the Rapids are looking at this and saying, this is 3 points that we need to get against a team that's beatable, and 3 points that you would expect of a team hoping to make the playoffs. And so in that, I think the Rapids get a win. I'll probably take 2-1 in this one. I think we'll see enough of a shift from Bruce Arena that the Rapids have some trouble adjusting. So maybe it ends up being 1-1, but ultimately I think, you know, whether it's playing on the road, having to play on short rest or something, that you know, that the Rapids are going to find a way to get an advantage in the final 20 minutes, and hopefully that leads to Kai Kamara dunking against, you know, the team he has the third most beef with of old clubs in MLS right now. Shall we head on to Ask HTHL, Mark?
Let's go.
All right, so we will start with a question that we got from one James Lukakovic. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And so James asks, alternate history question, Mark. In 2009, the Rapids protected one Jordan Harvey from the Philadelphia Union expansion draft and have an above-average MLS left back for the next 10 seasons, really the last decade since 2009 to 2019. How many Rocky Mountain Cups do the Rapids win, and do the Rapids still win the MLS Cup in 2010? Discuss.
I'm not a great historian of the Colorado Rapids for two reasons. One, you know, I wasn't really that familiar with the team until 7 years ago. So it's great. I kind of got into the Colorado Rapids right after they won Rocky Mountain Cup. And two, I have a terrible memory. I love looking things up. I love pontificating. I love thinking about things. And then I completely forget what I just said 20 minutes ago. So that's me. I do think Jordan Harvey would have solved a lot of problems for Colorado that they have had to deal with in the past of cycling through left backs, like Edgar Castillo and Maynor Figueroa and the whole hot mess that we went through in 2018, where we went through, I think, 5 different left backs that year. The year before
that. Right backs. Oh, yes.
Yeah, we were at right back. I think, you know, we've lost most of the Rocky Mountain Cups, since 2010, and I feel like that's one area that having one more good player would have helped. I think instead of, you know, losing most of them, we would have at least won 2 more with a guy like Jordan Harvey at left back.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Mark. I would say, you know, Jordan Harvey would have been an upgrade and would have at least been a good depth piece in 2010. So I don't see how, I don't think adding Jordan Harvey, if anything, he makes it easier for the Rapids to win MLS Cup, where, you know, they were still a massive underdog going into the playoffs and maybe weren't favored against FC Dallas in Toronto. I think he probably makes that easier. Maybe the Rapids have a higher seed, or they get a home playoff game, or, you know, they have an easier time, you know, especially playing down a man and up a goal against FC Dallas in the finals. So I think the Rapids still win MLS Cup. I don't know that they're close enough in any of the other seasons with Jordan Harvey to where that would have affected any of the other games that they've had. I don't know that just simply adding Jordan Harvey turns the Rapids from a bottom-of-the-barrel Western Conference team into a playoff team or even remotely competing for an MLS Cup. And the reason why I say that is if we go to, I would say as good as Jordan Harvey's been, I think even having him on the team even now today, where obviously he's, you know, a great stalwart at left back for LAFC, I don't know that that massively improves the good Mark Birch era aspect of the Rapids. I know he had 1 year right there where he was going through a really rough game, Mark, and I think there was a question of whether or not there was an injury or something else going on with him. But other than that, you know, Jordan Harvey and Mark Birch were very, very similar players. They're going to be mostly defensive. Their job is to completely shut down the opponent going against them. They're not going to get forward very often, but when they do, they're going to bring a little bit of skill, and generally something positive is going to occur. And in that, I think 2016 Mark Birch and anything the Rapids would have gotten from, you know, say a 2015 to a 2017 Jordan Harvey, I don't know that that is much different, and I'd have to go back and look at the salaries, and, you know, they were about on par. I think Jordan Harvey got a little bit of a pay bump when he came to LAFC, because LAFC has a bunch of money and they've got other room for the cap in the ways that the Rapids didn't. But I don't think that there's that much of a significant bump. Maybe Jordan Harvey is a minor upgrade over the Rapids to the point where they're able to get a result against Seattle Sounders, but I think at that point you're splitting hairs, and I think it's really close that that series is still at best a coin flip, and even then I'm not sure that the Rapids have that much of an advantage, even hosting a Toronto FC coming out of the Eastern Conference in that one. So I can't say that adding Jordan Harvey, I think he would have been an improvement or at least another option at 2016. I don't think he solves all of the problems that the Rapids were going through. The Rapids had major issues at the center back position, and they had major issues in a lot of the attack, and obviously in the level of bust that Juan Ramirez was. Whereas if you told me that, say, leaving Sporting Kansas City or coming back from Middlesbrough, that the Rapids get, you know, 2013 level Kai Kamara and have Kai Kamara from 2013 until now, I think we're having a very different conversation about the state of the Rapids, about the level of success that the Pablo Mastroeni would have been in, and are we even hearing the buzzword like the Rapids way with any frequency? And I think an upgrade like that would have been much more significant than Jordan Harvey, who I think would have been an improvement in the 2010 to 2013 span. I don't think is that much of a improvement over Mark Birch that moves the needle that significantly under that era. Now, certainly the 2018 season, like you talked about, or the 2017 season post Mark Birch trade, maybe we're having a very different conversation about how that season turned over, but I still think Sam Cronin was the main linchpin that was lost in that trade for Sam Nicholson. Or not Sam, was it Sam? No, that was Mohamed Saeed and Luis Gil? Was it Luis Gil, Mark? Mark?
Mohamed Saeed and Josh Gatt?
Oh my God, that trade was so bad. Okay, let's not think about that anymore. James, I hope we answered your question enough for you to get the brain juices moving on that in, you know, Rapids alternative history. Let's move on, Mark. We've got a couple questions from Matt Anderson. We will do one of them in rapid fire. We'll do two of them in rapid fire. First one, at what point does Connor Casey cease to be a new coach, in air quotes? At what point are we past the new coach bump? At what point does the bump become a trend and the trend become reality? I'm going to ask all these questions in order, Mark. We're going to do yes or no rapid fire. Are we past the point where Connor Casey is just a new coach, even if he still is an interim head coach? Yes or no?
He is the coach. He passed that after like six games.
Retweet. Are we past the point where this is a new coach bump? Yes or no?
We're past the new coach bump. They're no longer just excited about him. He now has to actually coach, and he has done it.
Yes, no, I agree. We're definitely past the new coach bump. What we're seeing is a trend that is on somewhat indicative of what Connor Casey's implementing and how the players have reacted to that and how they are executing what Connor Casey is tasking them with. And then at what point does the new coach bump become a trend and does the trend become a reality? I think we agree, Mark, off of the last question that the bump is now a trend. Is the trend reality, which goes into Matt's last question of, are the Rapids actually good?
Oh, are the Rapids actually good? I think they're pretty. I think they're decent. I think this is a 500 ball club that got such a bad start that they can't be a 500 ball club. Which is, you know, I mean, I think one of the hardest questions that pundits have to answer is how much was luck the first 10 games and how much was Anthony Hudson just absolutely getting every decision wrong? And, you know, I'd say it's a little bit of both. Hudson probably should have won three games out of there just based on luck. But he got unlucky, and that meant that, this team is probably out of the playoffs. So yeah, that's kind of my summary of how things have turned around under Connor Casey and what can be attributed to him.
Mark, I think whoever is launching the fireworks is trying to send us a literal smoke signal that they believe that the trend has become reality. Yeah. I tweeted this out after the game, Mark, that I've been beating this drum the last couple of weeks where I still have doubts about, you know, given the quality of opponent and some of the injuries and stuff, how much of what we were seeing was the new coach bump. I think we're past the point where it is the new coach bump, but I still have the question of who are the Rapids in terms of are they what they were under Anthony Hudson, you know, 07-2, whatever the record was, or are they this absolute juggernaut that really only has, you know, two draws and one loss under Connor Casey? I'm still reconciling with that. I still think the jury is out. I think we have to see how other teams are going to handle the transfer window, and we definitely see how the Rapids respond to playing good teams on the road who are at full strength. Say what you will about both teams missing players due to the Gold Cup, I think Walker Zimmerman was a bigger loss for Edward Atuesta. Those collectively were a bigger loss up the middle for LAFC than Jonathan Lewis was a loss for the Rapids in the wing battle, in which they were significantly undermanned and significantly outperformed previous results. I would like to see what the Rapids look like when they're not 100% and they're playing a team on a roll, like they will next Saturday when they have to play at the Portland Timbers, who've been fantastic since their new stadium opened up with the renovation of Providence Park. So the jury's still out with me, but I think the result on Friday is absolutely not a blip. I think it's indicative that this team is better, and I think the Rapids are closer to the juggernaut they've been than they are 07-2. Are they close enough to that juggernaut to the point where they can play catch up and potentially be a factor in the Western Conference? Could they make the playoffs? Could they potentially host a playoff game? My error bars are still over that, where I think the peak is probably them hosting a playoff game, and I still think the trough of, or the lower bar, the bottom of those error bars for me is still this team being slightly outside the playoffs, and I had them, I predicted them to finish eighth at the end of the season. So I think we're definitely outside the realm where they're not going to finish at the bottom of the Western Conference. I do not think, as much as I guaranteed it, come at me, Jeff Kazmir, that they will not get the wooden spoon. I'm still curious to see where they're going to finish in terms of the standings, and I still think we need more data on that in order to check that out. And my big concern with that, Mark, even though the gap in terms of points are so small, they still have to jump like four or five teams in order to make the playoffs. And, you know, that's with the Portland Timbers, who I think are probably going to make a run to the playoff. They're below the red line right now. I think somebody else is maybe going to make a move in the secondary transfer window that maybe guarantees them into the playoffs. But, you know, like could they jump the Houston Dynamo? Well, if Albert Elise gets sold and they don't make a right move in there, could I see Houston falling off? Yeah, possibly. You know, FC Dallas is still a really young team. Maybe they have a bad month and the coaching staff isn't able to, Lucha Gonzalez isn't able to get things squared away. I think we're past the point with the money that San Jose Earthquakes are going to spend that the Rapids are going to have a hard time catching them. I think they're going to have a hard time catching the two LA teams. Maybe if Seattle has a bad run, given that they no longer have Chad Marshall and just their defense is a little bit weaker without Marshall and without Ozzie Alonso, possibly. But, you know, could the Rapids jump the Vancouver Whitecaps? Yes. Could the Rapids jump Real Salt Lake, especially if they win that game, in the Rocky Mountain Cup later on this season? Absolutely. Houston, TBD. I have my doubts about Minnesota. Yeah, it's only 5 points, but the Rapids have to jump a bunch of teams, and that's where that last part of the season, where they've got a lot of road games against a lot of Western Conference teams, is going to be really, really critical. That's really, really far away, and there's plenty of time for other teams to make moves in the summer, where I don't think the Rapids are going to make as many moves, and that's why my error bars are still wide, even if they're on the top half of the table, where 5-10 games ago, the error bars was effectively, are they gonna, like, worst case scenario, they win the wooden spoon. Best case scenario, they barely don't win the wooden spoon. And then we've got one other thing, and I'll kind of jumble these together. We have a question, an Ask HTHL from Oozeworm Mark, that asks, at what point, going from that, referring to Matt Anderson's question about Casey and the rapid fire we did, at what point does Smith start to reconsider the necessity of a managerial search if results continue, even given the absolute disaster in his previous one, referring to Smith hiring Anthony Hudson? Will he hold on regardless? And then we also got a question from David Malafant via email, asking, just saw that the Springs fired their head coach, and then wondering about the percentage chance of Connor Casey ending there. We talked about this last week, Mark, with Connor Casey maybe needing another head coaching job in order to really build his resume for coaching at the MLS level, and USL being a viable option there. And do we think that the Rapids are waiting on this to happen first, in terms of waiting for the Springs to make a move move from Trishut, and then possibly coincidentally saying that Casey either is going to finish out the season as the interim head coach and then transition to coaching the switchbacks, or maybe that happens midseason in conjunction with the coaching hire. Mark, how are you making sense, given the current form of the team, of the word salad I just presented you that is Smith hiring a head coach, Casey's future with the team, and Smith even reconsidering a coaching hire, given the way things are going?
It's a lot of questions at once, man. You're confusing my tired brain at this late hour here on the East Coast. I mean, simply put, I don't think there's a plan. Like, oh, you know, firing Tricia opens up a job that we can give to Connor Casey, since we're definitely going to move Connor Casey off the job for the guy we've already hired. Like, that's a little bit farther along than I think is likely that they've thought of. I think the simple belief is that Connor Casey is likely to coach either through the end of the season or through the bulk of the end of the season. No matter how well he does, they will hire somebody else, and Connor Casey will be just fine. You know, my guess is that he was signed to an interim coach contract, which comes with a dope severance package that that comes when he finishes things out. So I'm not really worried about him. I also think that he has really done a good job of coaching this team right now, and has proven that he's ready to be a head coach at the MLS or USL level. You know, it's not as glorious coaching at the USL level, but you know, he may get a shot back in USL before he comes back up to MLS. That'd be my take about what likely happens over the next 4 months.
I think there's going to be we're going to see sometime between now and the start of the season next year for the USL what that relationship looks like between the Rapids and the Switchbacks. And are the Switchbacks actually trying to go for it and be effective and be a team that's going to challenge in the USL Championship in, you know, maybe not 2019, but certainly in 2020? Or are we heading maybe towards where some fans on both sides have speculated, where the Switchbacks officially transition to effectively Rapids to, even if the ownership group is still in place there, where, you know, with Brian Crookham being the general manager, that all of the technical decisions are made by the Rapids brain trust, and in that they're running it in a way that benefits them directly rather than a way that's trying to put out a competitive USL team, as we've seen from the Orlando Bees and the Toronto FC 2s and the LA Galaxy 2s of the USL and even into the lower divisions now. So I'm really curious to see what that looks like. I think in both of those scenarios, Connor Casey could be considered for that job. Whether or not he's interested, thinking, well, I've been a really good assistant for the first team, why can't I just continue to be an assistant for the first team? I had success under Paolo Mascherini. I was able to do some good things with Anthony Hudson, to the extent that I was able to step in for him and actually have success. Now, I think a lot of that and Connor's future is dependent upon what the opinion is of that next head coach, Mark. And I still think, I unless the Rapids win out the rest of the season and win the Supporter Shield and win MLS Cup, I don't see a scenario where Porik says, Casey, you're the head coach. Go back and listen to past episodes the last couple weeks, smokes on Mark and my argument behind that decision. But I think if the new head coach comes in and thinks, you know, Connor's done good work, he's got continuity in with the locker room, you know, his ideas offensively are not so far away from what I want to do offensively, I'll keep him on, and I think we'll be symbiotic. I think if that happens, I think Casey just jumps back into the same role that he was under Pablo, under Ant, and then that's a seamless transition for him. He stays with the same group and has success. If that new head coach wants to go in a radically different direction, wants to maintain the Rapids way or reestablish it rather in some capacity, then I think we could see some shifting in there. I have a hard time seeing that the Rapids as an organization is going to do Casey dirty like that, given Porik's learning experience with, you know, you could argue both Paul Bravo's departure from the club and certainly Paolo Mascherini's departure from the club that was Porik Smith's decision with support of ownership, that the Rapids are going to at least set Connor Casey up to be successful in some capacity. And if the head coach decides no opportunities with the coaching team, maybe, you know, a cush job from a scouting standpoint, or joining Porik in the front office, or going back to the academy, maybe doing something directly with Ryan Crookham. Like, I have a hard time seeing an outcome. I think the least likely outcome is Connor Casey, here's a contract, be the permanent head coach of the Rapids. I think the next most likely scenario is Connor, we've hired a new head coach, It isn't going to be you. Clean out your office. Thank you for your service. You're gone. I still think he's going to be involved in the club in some capacity. I'm not sure what that is. I think depending on the head coaching decision and how that head coach feels about how they could work with Connor with the first team could determine Connor's future with the team, and I think it'd be a seamless transition in terms of him going down to coach the USL side if he ended up wanting to coach the USL side. I think the bigger question, going back to Oozworm's questions about reconsidering it, I still think they're going to hire somebody. I still think it's not going to be Connor Casey, but I think the timing of that is probably still in doubt, and maybe this is something that under the table the Rapids have already decided, but it's going to be, you know, whoever that candidate is, it's going to be finish out the rest of the year, you'll take over as soon as the season's over, whenever that is. And they're just going to run it and see if Connor Casey can get anything productive out of this team, or at the very least, you know, give the players something good to fill out that then turns into momentum for them going into the next year. I have a hard time seeing with the good run of form right now that the Rapids are going to disrupt that by having a coach immediately take over and step into that locker room. I think if they do make a decision to bring in somebody new and have them take over in this season, it's going to have to take a bad run to where, okay, then we need to make another switch, or to the point where the Rapids are eliminated from the playoffs, in which case let the new guys start building for the future. Listeners, you can find us individually on Twitter at @soccer_rabbi, at LWS Matt Pollard. Check us out at Rapids96Podcast on Twitter. Send us your questions using the hashtag AskHGHL. If you've got something that's longer than 280 characters or want to get in touch in some other way, Rapids96Podcast@gmail.com. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. We're most recently on iHeartRadio. You can listen to us on iHeartRadio, both the website as well as via the app, streaming for free, and you can download episodes. Our full archive should be available to you as well if you wanted to switch over to that platform. Find us wherever else you get your podcasts. Tell your friends, share us on social media, rate and review us on said platforms. Head on over to denverpost.com/HTHL for a special deal through us on the Denver Post digital content, Mark's related stuff, Jake Shapiro, Brett Kisla, all the stuff going on with the Rockies and soon the Broncos as well. And if you think that we bring monetary value to your lives, head on over to patreon.com/Rapids96Podcast. Listeners, we'll see you next week as we talk about what the Rapids did against the Revolution and preview the first ever game for the Pids at the new and improved Providence Park. We'll see you then.